Welcome back to Dakota Midday from South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Carl Gerke. There's an estimated 137 million artifacts, works of art, and specimens in the vast archives of the Smithsonian Institution. Richard Curran, Undersecretary for History, Art, and Culture of the Smithsonian, and some of his colleagues went through those millions of objects to select just 101 that tell the story of America. Those objects range from dinosaur bones to space suits and include President Lincoln's hat, Sitting Bull's ledger, Dorothy's red ruby slippers from The Wizard of Oz, and the Enola Gay bomber. They're all featured in a 762-page book called The Smithsonian's History of America in 101 Objects. Richard Curran is coming to Pier this Monday for a series of events, including an evening talk at the Capitol Lake Visitor Center that will also stream live on our website, sdpb.org. And Richard Curran joins us on the line from Washington, D.C. And Dr. Curran, welcome to Dakota Midday.
Well, thank you. Good to be here.
Well, I imagine that the biggest challenge in putting together this book was just narrowing down the objects to just 101.
Yeah, well, getting from 137 million, many of which curators and scientists and scholars at the Smithsonian think very strongly about and very passionately about, is not easy. And, you know, I solicited different suggestions about how to do it. And you can only imagine the stamp curators at the Smithsonian saying, hey, 101 objects, 100 should be stamps. But we got through it. We got there.
Did you start out with some objects that you knew you had to include in the book?
Yeah, I think some are iconic that, you know, and I looked at, you know, what our visitors, the Smithsonian gets about 30 million people a year to come to its museums. And, you know, people will come and see the Star Spangled Banner. You're not going to leave out the Star Spangled Banner. And people, you know, look at George Washington's uniform and sword and Lincoln's hat and Dorothy's ruby red slippers and Kermit the Frog. And so, you know, there's popular favorites among our audiences, the American people, that I felt I had to include.
Now, for the lesser known pieces, what are some of those that are included in the book?
Well, you know, I really wanted to round out the history of our country, and there's some objects that have never been on display. Now, one of my favorite ones is something called the Bakerizer. It's a hideous object. You'd never want to put it on display. It looks totally ugly. It's very industrial. It looks like it has a lot of goop all over it. But that was the basically the oven that cooked the first plastic. And so when you think of us living, you know, we don't live in the Stone Age anymore, the Iron Age. We live in the age of plastics. And we have it, the machine, the first machine fabricated plastic that led to that whole era. And we've never displayed it at the Smithsonian. I felt I needed to put it in this book because it was so important in terms of our everyday life today.
You mentioned that, for example, the people that were taking care of the stamps wanted 101 stamps. In working and asking the other people at the Smithsonian what to include in the book, were there sometimes maybe heated discussions about what should be in this book?
Yeah, you know, because everybody has their favorites. You know, look, as a kid, I collected, you know, comic books, baseball cards, some coins, some stamps. And, you know, so I have my favorites. But just imagine, you know, people at the Smithsonian, are people who curate toys. They want the teddy bear had to be in the book and didn't quite make it. Maybe 102 or 103, but not 101. So, yes, I had very spirited discussions with my colleagues about what would be in here and what not. But I think overall it really does tell the story of America. And, you know, hey, other folks could be inspired to write their own 101 or 250 or 500.
Why 101?
Well, there was a British guy a few years ago, Neil McGregor, the head of the British Museum, and he wrote A History of the World in 100 Objects. And he used the collection of the British Museum. And it was successful. The publisher called me at the Smithsonian. And they said, Richard, how about writing a book about American history? And I said, yes, I would love to. My wife, who teaches in a public school, we live in Northern Virginia. Kids aren't learning history. They're not learning civics. And she said, you have to do it. It's just not in the curriculum anymore, and Americans have to know their history. And I certainly agree with that, you know, given my position at the Smithsonian. So I said, I'll do it. I told the publishers I'll do it. I said, I had only one condition. They said, what's the one condition? I said, well, you know, the British guy, he had 100. We're Americans. I need 101. So that's how that got to be that way.
Now, this is a 762-page book, 101 Objects. How do you see this book being used and being read? Do you see this as something that can be used in the classroom? Do you see this as an accessible book for anyone, maybe as an introduction to history, or even a book for people who maybe know a lot about history as well?
Totally. Look, it's not written. There is a whole footnote section that we mercifully left on the web. So that would have expanded the book by about 100 pages. But, you know, it's not a, boring, dry book. It's really in a storytelling mode. It's about what significance these objects had at that time in history and how they ended up standing for parts of our heritage, whether it be musical or political, scientific, the natural world. So it's really much more of a storytelling of American history than it is a kind of dry scholarly tale. I've spoken to a lot of teacher groups, social studies groups around the country. History Day has taken it on. A number of people, because I think it's a very accessible book. You know, a lot of people learn history and expect it's like, do I really have to learn those names and dates? And it's so abstract. And in this way, I start with a wonderful picture of every object. And I start with, you know, Abraham Lincoln's hat. Look at this hat. Why is a guy who's 6'4" wearing a top hat like this? And how come it's a silk top hat and not a fur cap? Wasn't Lincoln from the frontier? And look inside the hat, and you don't see any tags. Well, they didn't have sizes at that time. And standard, you know, clothing didn't get standardized until the Civil War. We needed uniforms and hats much later, women's clothing much later than that. And look at this hat. It has a mourning band around it. Why was Lincoln wearing a mourning band? Well, his son died in the war, and he wanted to show that he was mourning his son, just like Americans were mourning their sons in the Civil War. So just starting out from the hat, you can get into all sorts of issues about history at that time. And, of course, that was the hat he wore April 14th, 1865, when he went to Ford's Theater, put it down next to him when he watched the play, and he was assassinated. So, and then it later got locked up in the Smithsonian, wouldn't even show his hat. They were worried about, you know, that people would have irrational reverence for that hat. So they locked it away in the Smithsonian. They wouldn't show it for 30 years. So I kind of use the object as a way into history. It's a very easy and compelling way into historical occurrences, events, and patterns.
What's interesting there, as you're just talking about, then you also get into the way we relate to these objects as well.
Yeah, and no question about it. You know, the one of the interesting ones, you know, that I deal with is the buffalo, for example. Now, this a lot of people don't necessarily connect, but the Smithsonian operates the National Zoo. So we have about 2,200 animals, and we have to cook breakfast for them every day. But the story of the buffalo is so intriguing because we had a taxidermist at the Smithsonian back in the 1880s who wanted to put together, you know, as probably many listeners, you know, have gone to museums, you've seen a diorama, and you see a stuffed buffalo. Okay, well, that's interesting. He wanted to stuff buffaloes in a way that he'd capture their movement, their musculature, and so on. He'd never seen a live buffalo. He just had buffalo skins at the Smithsonian. Goes out west, can't find a buffalo because we've now killed most of the buffalo. Finds a small calf, doesn't have the heart to shoot it, takes it back with a small number of buffalo to Washington, puts them in a fenced compound so he can watch how they run, so he knows how to stuff buffalo better. Well, people start coming out to watch, and a lot of people in the East Coast never seen a buffalo. All of a sudden, they say, bring us more animals. The Smithsonian becomes kind of like Noah's Ark. We get about 120 animals, and that is the basis of the National Zoo. So what started out as a taxidermist quest ends up becoming a real cause celeb for conservation because he realizes that we have these species that we're wiping out, and we can't do that. So this fellow, this taxidermist William Hornaday, really with Teddy Roosevelt and others, almost single-handedly starts the whole conservation movement in the country.
You're listening to Dakota Midday on South Dakota Public Broadcasting, and we're talking with Richard Curran, Undersecretary of History, Art, and Culture, at the Smithsonian. We're talking about the book, The Smithsonian's History of America in 101 Objects. And Dr. Kern is in Pierre on Monday. He's giving an evening presentation at the Capitol Lake Visitor Center that will also stream live on our website at sdpb.org. And Dr. Kern, the buffalo, obviously very something of vital interest to South Dakotans in particular. Some of the other objects that kind of get at South Dakota history anyway, there's the Conestoga wagon and Lewis and Clark's pocket compass.
Well, Lewis and Clark's pocket compass, I mean, you know, look, you know, Jefferson, you know, in basically got the idea of, you know, Lewis, you know, Meriwether Lewis, who is his aide, and then Clark to go and map basically the rest of the continent, get out to the Pacific. And so he had them go to Philadelphia. They got instructions and various objects, and he had a whole list. He made a list of them of, you need to get this thing and this thing and this thing. They bought a compass, a wonderful compass for $5. It was a pocket compass, a leather pouch, wooden mahogany, really finely made. And they really learned that that was the compass that helped them navigate across the country, map it, and, you know, define our future nationhood. And it was the only piece of equipment, the only piece of scientific equipment. We have their maps and so on, but it was the only piece of scientific equipment that actually came back with them that comes down to us today. And so I look at that compass, and I think a lot of visitors to the Smithsonian look at the compass and say, wow, that is the compass that helped Lewis and Clark navigate themselves across the country and really open it up for the rest of us. So that, you know, you really look at the compass, it still works. And you really are very close to a piece of history.
In putting this book together, you're mentioning some of the items from popular culture. It almost seemed to me that maybe those might be the most difficult ones to choose which went in the book and which didn't, because it seems like you know, how do you rate those things? Unlike something in history, you can say, yeah, Lewis and Clark's compass is very important, but Kermit the Frog, how does that fit in?
Yeah, well, it's hard. You know, look, I wanted to tell a rounded story of our country, and some of the things from popular culture, you know, sometimes they have to sit a few years until you kind of can appreciate their relevance, and we don't know, you know, with all sorts of celebrity happenings and you know, things these days, it's very hard to pick out and choose. But over time, you kind of see certain things happening, and you know, I guess the first big one that I have in the book in that category is probably Mickey Mouse. We have, you know, the some original cells of Mickey Mouse from Steamboat Willie. Well, look what Disney became. You know, and look what it became in the eyes of, I don't know if you have kids, but, you know, my kids, I mean, that was what they grew up on, and it's what many people around the world have grown up on, and it became a much larger thing than it started out as. So I try to include those things that have significance. Similarly, Dorothy's ruby red slippers. Now, you know, originally in the book by Frank Baum in the early 1900s, you know, that was really a parody about Washington and the gold standard and silver standard, and those slippers ended up becoming ruby red. They were originally silver in the script, but a technological process had been just developed the year before while they were filming the movie, and that technological process was Technicolor. And in Technicolor, silver kind of looked like a washed out gray. So they made the slippers ruby. So in telling the story of popular culture, which is, you know, at a time of depression in the United States when people were having a hard time, you know, here's Dorothy, Judy Garland, saying there's no place like home. It helped Americans reinvest in the value of their home and family and friends and people that were important, appreciate what was important to them. But it also tells this technological story of a new invention that helped shape the whole motion picture industry. So I try to pick popular culture items that had kind of a big story to tell that just weren't there because of their, you know, popularity or fan base, but had a larger story.
That's what's so amazing as I hear you talk about these items. There's just so many different layers to these things that really give us more of a context and take us in different directions and different journeys and understanding of different elements of our culture and history.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You know, look, there's a tendency. I work in the museum world, and some of your listeners probably read in the paper how, you know, some artwork just sold for $80 million, and this is so valuable. And, you know, so our first tendency to think about things is, you know, either think about them because they're famous or they're worth a lot of money. And, you know, in the book, I certainly deal with that, but I try to deal with what their history, you know, why are they worth a lot of money? And why are they so well known? And how did they get that way? And what do they tell us about both the times at that time, but also what do they tell us about what we then later valued and how we later took our, you know, understood our history? So I try to get at the backstory.
Well, Dr. Curran, working at the Smithsonian Institute, institution among all these items and objects, millions of them, that sounds like that's just must be a remarkable, amazing job to have.
Well, it's a great job. And, you know, I mean, look, we appreciate the American people. We're supported, you know, probably about 60% by, you know, tax dollars that help take care of the collections and so on. And then, you know, 40% from philanthropy and sponsorship and, you know, people buying Smithsonian products and eating in the restaurants and so on, watching Smithsonian Channel or getting Smithsonian Magazine. So, you know, we feel very well supported by the American people. We're very grateful to that. But a lot of those visitors who come to the Smithsonian often don't understand the research behind the Smithsonian. And so in the book, I try to get at some of the things that people, again, don't see. For example, we have about 300 astrophysicists who do work on the universe. So it's not all in the museums. And those one of the objects in the book I deal with is the giant Magellan telescope, this great big telescope we're trying to build in Chile that will allow us to see back close to the Big Bang. Well, Smithsonian has a long history in doing astrophysical research, you know, they help us explore. We run several space missions for NASA and so on. So I kind of tell some of those stories. Or even at the Smithsonian, we have the bird ladies. We have collections of millions and millions of birds. And whenever there's a plane strike, whenever a bird strikes a plane in the United States, they send the remains to the Smithsonian. And it's our scientists and curators that use our collection as kind of a reference base, a database. It's almost like, you know, a species fingerprint, you know, archive. So we can identify those birds and we can help, you know, aviation authorities so there's not future bird strikes in the future. So the Smithsonian has all sorts of things that happen with it, and I love working at the place because it really does value its mission, which is the increase in diffusion of knowledge or doing research and education. We do a lot of it.